Good evening. It is good to see everyone. I feel like I should be standing this way, but I want to try and stand this way instead. We need to even out a little bit, or we're going to have to be lifting up the side of the building, especially if you've got me sitting on this side that's already kind of got a lot of folks on it. It is good to see everyone, and we appreciate you coming out and being with us as we continue this study. We began last Lord's Day evening beginning to look at the period of time there at the close of the book of Daniel, the close of the book of Malachi, and looking at the period of time that occurs between the Testaments, oftentimes called the silent 400 years. And one of the reasons why we started going into this is because as we were reading Ezekiel and Daniel and looking through these things and seeing the period of time they lived in and the events that were occurring and the visions that they were seeing that foretold of this time, this is really a period of time that gets overlooked way too much. We just automatically jump from the Old Testament right into the New Testament. And we fail to realize what we're missing out on by just completely leaving that 400 years out. As we noted in our lesson last week, when you jump straight from the Old Testament to the New Testament, you go from a time of the Medes and the Persians to the time of the Romans. You go from a time where they were meeting the last we really read of them, they're meeting in the temple, they're worshiping at the temple in Jerusalem. After that's destroyed, we don't really read much about it. And then all of a sudden we read about these synagogues. We don't read anything about Pharisees and Sadducees in the Old Testament. We read about them in the New Testament. And so there's a need to look at this period of time so that we can have a better understanding of how things went from where they were in the Old Testament to what we have and what we can see in the New Testament. Now, as we're looking at this, one of the things we've been trying to keep in mind is we have very limited material in the Scriptures. You have the writings of Daniel, the writings of Ezekiel, the writings of some things of Jeremiah and such that have a little bit of information about this. Primarily, Daniel gives us the most information when we look at inspiration of the Holy Spirit as to this period of time. When he's looking at the various visions that King Nebuchadnezzar had in the kingdoms that were to follow afterwards. And so we're using that somewhat as our timeline to follow through. Now, I'm going to do the best that I can not to make this some boring history lecture. A lot of times people look at history and they're just like, oh, seriously, can we just move on? But, you know, as I mentioned last week, if we don't learn from the mistakes of those that have gone before us, we are destined to repeat them. And we need to have as much of an understanding as possible of the events that occurred. And one of the things that amazes me so much when you read about all the things that happened during the time after the close of the book of Malachi, and you go through the Medo-Persians and the Grecians and the Romans, and you see where they're taking over nation after nation, destroying, that through all of that upheaval, God keeps that remnant that He promised. That remnant was going to return. He keeps that number there in Jerusalem so that when the time came, when the fullness of time came, He could bring forth His Son from the line of David. And so let's keep these things in mind. Now remember, Assyria conquered Israel in 721 B.C. Oh, I skipped over a part. Another thing is, when we look at this period of time, I know I turned that on. Something's not getting from one place to another. Oh, well. Y'all just have to take my word that this is how the things are pronounced. It says it's on, but you may want to try and reset it, Chuck, if you don't mind. But as we look at these things, we want to keep in mind that it was during this period of time that some of the greatest discoveries were made, some of the greatest events occurred, as I was fixing to try to show you. And there's my Southern English there, fixing to try to show you. You've got the seven great world wonders of the ancient world that were presented and built in that period of time. And one of those is the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, built by King Nebuchadnezzar. You've also got the Temple of Zeus. You've got the Lighthouse of Pharos there in Alexandria of Egypt. All of these things are taking place during this period of time in between. Now, I was going to show you, this is a world map that we're looking at, a modern world map. It's still not going. It's cooling off. And when we look at this area, we need to keep in mind the Persian Gulf region that we're thinking about Just look at all the maps that you see on the news. That's the area we're talking about. Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Jordan. All of these, that's the area where Babylon is taking place. That's the area where the nation of Assyria, the empire of Assyria is. All these things are right there in that area. And so if you remember from our lesson last week, we looked at with the divided kingdom of Israel and Judah, that around 721 B.C., Assyria conquered Israel, took it into captivity, and really dispersed it, the nation of Israel dispersed it throughout the Assyrian Empire. Now, they ruled over the Middle East for a period of about 100 years. And throughout that rule, you had the Babylonians and you had the Medes that were trying to throw off their rule. They were there in the outer areas. There we go. These are just some pictures of the seven wonders, the Great Pyramid, Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, the Temple of Statue of Zeus there at Olympia, Mausoleum at Halicarnassus, the Colossus of Rhodes. Interesting thing about that, you could fit the Statue of Liberty between the legs. That gives you an idea of just how tall that statue is. And then the lighthouse there of Alexandria. Another interesting thing, if you remember, I talked about last week the translating of the Old Testament scriptures into Greek. Well, that took place, according to the legends, that took place at the base of the lighthouse there in Alexandria when 70 elders of the Jewish people came together and translated it supposedly in 70 days, which is where we get the idea Septuagint, which means 70. And so once again, this is the land that we're looking at. This is the modern countries, the area of Pakistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, all these areas. This is where we're looking at when we're looking at the Medes and the Persians, the Babylonians. Baghdad is really not that far from where Babylon was. And then you've also got Nineveh up in this area, Assyria. This was all under the control of the Assyrians when they took over Israel. And if you remember, I pointed out, you know, you just have this little tiny nation of Judah there remaining when Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, was taken captive. And it remains like that for about 100 years. But if you look there on the borders of the Assyrian Empire, you've got the Medes here, and then Persia, the Medes and the Persians, that's what we're going to be talking about next week, Lord willing. Babylon, they were all within the control or on the borders of the control of the Assyrian Empire, and eventually the Babylonians and the Medes worked together and succeeded in 612 B.C. in conquering the city of Nineveh, and later went on to conquer the city of Carchemish, which they had used to build a second place there for the Assyrians to reign. And that brought them to an end. And that brings us into the Babylonians. Now, it's interesting to look at the history of the Babylonians. When you look in the Scriptures, the Babylonians are also called Chaldeans. And we all know a famous individual from Chaldea, right? Abraham from the Ur of the Chaldees. And so the area of Chaldea, the area of Babylon, goes back very, very far in history. Ur was a prosperous city during the days of Abraham, and that was around 2000 B.C. The Tower of Babel was built supposedly within the walls of the city of Babylon. Babylon itself was said to be 60 miles long, extending the wall around Babylon was said to be 60 miles long, extending 35 feet underground. Herodotus said it was 352 feet high, 85 feet thick. Made of bricks 1 foot square and 3 or 4 inches thick. It was protected with 250 towers, guard rooms for soldiers, 25 gates, moats, drawbridges, and stone piers. The magnificent building that adorned the city, once again, the palace of Nebuchadnezzar that he had made for his Median wife, Amytis. And it was said that there were 53 temples and 180 altars there to the worship of Ishtar. But when we look back to the beginning of Babylon, it was very early, and they were ruled simply by what we would look at as modern-day sheiks. They were various tribes, and you can kind of put it into, I look at it as the Scottish clans. You've got a bunch of clans, and they all want to rule, but no one wants to agree with anyone else. And that's essentially what you had in that period of time. Until a man by the name of Ereba Marduk, and I'm going to just go ahead, this is how I pronounce them. It's not necessarily the right way, it's just the way it rolls off my tongue. and sounds good to me. But if you pronounce it some other way, you're more than likely the proper pronunciation. He was the one that founded the dynasty of the kings that lead us through the Babylonian Empire. In 747 BC, a man by the name of Nebuchadnezzar came to power. And it's interesting, when you read throughout the scriptures, when we read of the Chaldeans, they were there and amongst all the rulers. The Egyptians turned to the Chaldeans. All these rulers throughout time turned to the Chaldeans. They're oftentimes lumped with the magicians. And the thing is, during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, the study of astronomy made leaps and bounds, and the Greeks even turned back to this period of him and say that it was the turning point in the study of science. In 722, we have the first Babylonian king mentioned in the scriptures, Merodach-Baladan. If you remember him, Hezekiah is king over Judah, and he's sick. And Merodach, he says, "Well, let's check and see how old Hezekiah is doing." And he sends an envoy down, and Hezekiah foolishly says, "Here, look at all the riches that we have within the temple." And it was from that the prophet Isaiah prophesied and said that those riches that he had shown to Merodach-Baladan and the people would be taken captive into Babylon. Now, of course, that didn't happen for quite some time, but that prophecy was made. It seems that Merodach-Baladan was successful in uniting the tribes and bringing them into a more cohesive unit. But he ultimately failed when he went to fight against the Assyrians. In 625 BC, almost a century after Merodach-Baladan, we have a man by the name of Nabopolassar who came to the throne there in Babylon. He succeeded where Merodach-Baladan failed, conquered the Assyrians, and made Babylon the major power in the region. You remember when we looked at the Assyrians? They ruled all of this area, even on down into Egypt. Now, Egypt under the pharaohs were able to throw off the Assyrian rule and remained a thorn. In fact, this area of Judah, before Babylon came in and completely took over, this area of Judah was a war area between Pharaoh Necho and the Egyptians and the Babylonians and Assyrians. But as you can see, Babylon is able to conquer Jerusalem. When Nabopolassar died in 605 BC, he was marching against Egypt, and Nebuchadnezzar was there marching with him. When Nebuchadnezzar received news that his father had died, he took a few of the soldiers, and they were down here heading towards Egypt, and he went across the desert. Normally the route would be to go up along the coast and come down along the rivers, because this is a very deserted area. If you've ever seen the movie Hidalgo with Viggo Mortensen, that's kind of the area that he's going through, this very deserted area. No one lives there but maybe a few nomads. Very difficult terrain. But to gain control, he traveled back across the desert there to Babylon to take control. And so we have Nebuchadnezzar ruling during the days of 605 to 561 BC. And it's interesting to look at how quickly the kings fall by the wayside. Now you've got King Josiah, which if you remember was the last good king that Judah ever had. And his sons are taking over. And Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, was taken captive by Pharaoh Necho and carried down into Egypt and remained there in bondage. And Pharaoh appointed Jehoiakim, who was another son of Josiah, as king. When Nebuchadnezzar came through and took all the gold and such from the temple and took the goods, the best of the people, Daniel being one of those, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he kills Jehoiakim, and he puts Jehoiachin, Jehoiakim's son, in his place. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar comes back through and takes the second captivity, this would be Ezekiel and the 10,000 that were staying there at the river Chebar outside from Babylon. He takes Jehoiachin with him and Zedekiah, who is Josiah's other son. He would be the uncle of Jehoiachin, is put there in his place. Now, Zedekiah, once again, all of these kings are not good kings. They were warned by Jeremiah to submit to Babylon. They were warned by Jeremiah, don't go and ally yourself with Egypt. Just accept the things that are coming and things will go well. In fact, when Jeremiah begins prophesying, he tells them, if we do these things right, then we'll have a city to come back to. When God is done with us, when our time is through, then we'll have a city to come back to. But when Nebuchadnezzar returns that third time and takes everyone captive but the very poor, Zedekiah has his sons put to death right before his eyes, before Nebuchadnezzar pokes his eyes out. Can you imagine that being the last thing you ever see is the death of your children? And then being carried off into captivity. And this is where we find the destruction of Jerusalem. Not only knowing that your sons have been put to death, you're blinded, you're carried into captivity, but the beautiful temple that had been built by Solomon, the city of Jerusalem that had been of the people of God for so many years, was completely and utterly destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar spent his later years improving the city of Babylon. This is another picture depicting the hanging gardens of Babylon, the beauty of the city. Nebuchadnezzar continued to reign for another 43 years and died at the age of 80, about 561 BC, ending what's known to be as the most memorable reign of any Assyrian or Babylonian king. I don't care if people aren't even aware of the Scriptures and Nebuchadnezzar in the Scriptures, they know about Nebuchadnezzar. Now, one of the things I want to focus on is that during this period of time that the Jews are in captivity. Remember, when Zedekiah was taken captive, the temple was destroyed. The city of Jerusalem was destroyed. They have been going to Jerusalem since the days of David to worship God. Since the days of Solomon, they have been worshiping there in the temple. Now you've got a period of hundreds upon hundreds of years, generation after generation, that's where they went. And it's now destroyed. And so, and these are just some additional pictures of the city of Babylon and some of the restoration that's been done. But when the Jews find themselves in Babylon, they're far away from Jerusalem, they have to find some way to worship God. And so, congregations begin to form in various areas, and they form what we know as synagogues. This is where we find the first of the synagogues there that we read about so much. And in fact, in Jerusalem, there was a number of synagogues there in Jerusalem, even though the temple had been rebuilt. Even though they had a place that they could come together as the people of God and worship again, they still had all these synagogues because the synagogues allowed all these opposing points of views. There'd be a Pharisaean synagogue, there'd be a Sadducee synagogue, there'd be a synagogue for the Essenes, a synagogue for Zealots. Just synagogues throughout the city. And this is where we find them developing. This is where it all begins. Now, for a synagogue to be fully organized, it was required, and these are all things that the Jews came up themselves. There was no direction from God whatsoever. But they would have to have seven elders, and one of those elders would be the leader, the ruler of the synagogue. And that's why when we go over to Lydia, you remember in Philippi, we see Lydia and the women out at the river worshiping God. Well, obviously there was no synagogue there. And this is how we can know that there was most likely not a synagogue. Now, the captivity and presence of all these Jews in Babylon brought further complications. The Jews had realized, okay, we can't keep messing around with idolatry. God's through messing with us. He's not just bringing people in and bringing us captive and making us pay to them. He's actually taking us out of our homeland. He's destroying our city. And so we see the Jews, as they go into this Babylonian captivity, that they really turn back fervently to God and they refuse to worship the idols. We can see that in the book of Daniel, if you remember in our readings, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego... Nebuchadnezzar has commanded, when you hear the psaltery, the lyre, the flute, the bagpipe, when you hear all these instruments to play, you're to bow down before this image that I created. And everybody bows down but Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And it's because the people knew that they would remain faithful to God. The same thing we find with Daniel during the days of the Medes and the Persians. The only thing they can find against Daniel is that he's going to serve God, that he's going to continue to petition God as he was always doing. And so it raised problems because God blessed them. Even though they were carried away into captivity, God blessed them. In fact, many Jews, when the time came, when you get on over into the Medes and the Persians, when Cyrus says, all right, you can return to your homeland, many are like, I kind of like it here. I got a good business. We've got a good house. So we've got everything's going pretty well. I've become wealthy. Because remember, they had been there for 70 years. Jeremiah said, when you go, you buy land and make yourself a home there. God will prosper you if you'll serve Him. And God fulfilled that. God took care of them. Daniel was lifted up to be one of the three leaders underneath Nebuchadnezzar. Only Nebuchadnezzar was above him. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were lifted up in their positions. God was blessing the Israelites, and this turned many against them in trying to find ways to put an end to them. Now, in the meantime, as these things are going on, Nebuchadnezzar thinks he's an animal. There's a medical term for this, lycanthropy. And you remember in our readings in the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar had reached a point, he was there in the city of Babylon, and he was looking out over all the beautiful works that he had done. And he said essentially, surely there's no one on earth like Nebuchadnezzar. And just like that, God judged him. Not immediate death. No, God had another lesson for him to learn. And Nebuchadnezzar spent a period of time living amongst the wild animals. We read that his hair and his beard grew to where it looked like feathers. His fingers began to look like claws. He didn't eat human food. He didn't speak the Babylonian language. He didn't take part in anything human. He lived purely as an animal, living amongst the trees and the dew being upon him. As we can look there, we see that this was something that Daniel that was brought upon Nebuchadnezzar. And we have some, they're called oftentimes uninspired words that Nebuchadnezzar, when he comes to himself, when he comes out of it. But really we can see from the things that God had done to him, there was the inspiration. But in Daniel 4, the result of Nebuchadnezzar going through this period of madness, says that he learned that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. You know, that's something that we need to think about as we're looking at this period of time between the Testaments. These people are coming to power because that's what God wanted to happen. The Babylonians overcame the Assyrians because that's what God wanted to happen. The Assyrians overcame the Israelites and all those before them because God wanted to happen. The Babylonians fell to the Medes and the Persians because that's what God wanted to happen. We've got to keep that in mind. And so as we look at these things, we need to continue to think about the things that are occurring. That God is in the details. God is in the mix. And even today, as I taught this morning, we as Americans, we get a little arrogant. We go, nobody can touch us. We're the biggest. We're the baddest. We've got the most nuclear weapons. We've got the best trained army. We've got the best toys. We need to remember, without God, we're nothing. I question when people say that this used to be a nation built upon God. When you look at some of the founding fathers and their viewpoints on various things, they were not exactly turning to God. But God was in the beginning there. It was in the planning. When with the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal there by their Creator. They have these inalienable rights. Now as we go and look through these things, we can see once again Daniel, if you remember the vision that we looked at last week when Nebuchadnezzar had this vision of a statue and Daniel gave the interpretation of that vision, the head of gold, he said, was you, O King Nebuchadnezzar. He said, there's going to be one that's going to come after you that is inferior to thee. That's the belly, the breast and arms of silver. And then the belly and thighs of brass is going to be another third kingdom that's going to bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom will be strong as iron. And we can look throughout the Scriptures, specifically there in Daniel, and Daniel is saying, all right, the Babylonians, they're great, they're mighty, they're powerful, but there's going to come an end to their empire. And it doesn't take very long looking at the history of the Babylonians that after the days of Nebuchadnezzar, they went downhill rather quickly. Nebuchadnezzar's son, I guess he was aptly named, Evil-Merodach, ruled for 2 years. His son, Nergal-Sarnessar, ruled 3 years. The next king, Labosaurus, ruled 1 year. Evil-Marduk only ruled 2 years because he was murdered there on the throne. The people had risen up against him. He was replaced by Nergal-Sarnessar, who reigned for 3 years. And then Labosaurus was murdered after a year. Kind of a bad run for the king. 6 years. You remember that Nebuchadnezzar had ruled for over 40 years. And in 6 years, they've gone through three kings. Then we read of a fellow by the name of Nabonidus, who was a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar, who took over in the place there as king. And he ruled along with his son Belshazzar, who, as we read in the scriptures, is noted as being a son of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, it's interesting, his mother was Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, so that's where the son, the grandson, would come into play. Now, it is this Belshazzar that we read of with the handwriting on the wall. You see, Nabonidus, his dad, he loved history. He loved archaeology. He loved learning about all the gods that were available. And so he spent his time out gallivanting around the Babylonian Empire, looking for ancient cities to dig up, looking for gods to worship. And Belshazzar was left in charge, and like the typical prince turned king, hey guys, let's have a party. Let's have a party. And you know what? We've got this really fine goldware that we recovered from Jerusalem. It came out of, I think it was their temple. Let's bring that on in here and let's eat, drink, and be merry. And it is at that point in time that God revealed the end of the Babylonian Empire. And the words, meeni, meeni, tekel, apharsin, which means essentially, you've been weighed, you've been balanced, and you've been found wanting. Destruction is upon you. And that very night, the Medes and the Persians took control of Babylon with really no fight whatsoever. You see, the handwriting on the wall was there to fulfill the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah, some that were told 200 years prior. In Isaiah 13, if you remember in our reading, we read that Babylon was to be destroyed like Sodom and Gomorrah. Jeremiah said that the Babylonians would refuse to fight. The princes of Babylon would be drunk, Jeremiah 51. In Jeremiah 51, we read about the post and messengers that would tell the king his city was taken at one end. In other words, it's going to be taken before the king knows anything about it. In Jeremiah 51, Jeremiah talks about the kings of the Medes that would attack. Isaiah says the kings of the north, which is where the Medes and the Persians came from. Isaiah and Jeremiah both speak of Babylon never being inhabited again. It's interesting. Some of the Iraqi history, Saddam Hussein had a great desire to rebuild Babylon. But it didn't exactly pass. Throughout all this time, Babylon was there from the days of Noah and the gathering together there, building the Tower of Babel. It was built by a great grandson of Noah. All that history, and from that point on, Babylon is no more. Babylon is destroyed. Jeremiah prophesied of that 70 years prior. You see, these prophecies were fulfilled in the fall of Babylon before the armies of Cyrus in 538 BC. The name of Cyrus has oftentimes been surrounded by legends so that no one knows for sure where he comes from. He's supposed to be a grandson of Astyages, the king of Media. And we'll look at these things in a little more detail next week, Lord willing, when we look at the Medes and the Persians. It's said that Astyages had warning dreams about him and sought to put him to death because when you have dreams about someone that's taking your place and you're a king, one of the things we're going to find during this time between the Testaments, you put them to death. Doesn't matter if they're your son. Doesn't matter if they're your wife, your daughter, your father. Doesn't matter. You put them to death so that you can become a king. And he did all that he could. And we find around 559 B.C., Cyrus inherited the throne of Anshan, a Median province, and led an army against Astyages. After several battles and several desertions, where Astyages would send some of his captains to go and to take Cyrus, and they go, hey, we like Cyrus. So they would side with him, and then turn and fight the king of the Medes and the Persians. And finally, Cyrus captured Ecbatana. He turned towards Lydia. Lydia came out against him. And Cyrus did something a little different. I didn't know this before I studied this. Horses don't really care for camels. And Cyrus knew this. And so when they went into battle, he put all the camels in the front line. And the Lydian horsemen could not get their horses to go anywhere near the camels. And so he gained the battle and then turned toward Babylon, where once again, Nabonidus is out digging in the dirt. Belshazzar is having fun. And Herodotus, the historian, tells us that Cyrus dug a new channel for the Euphrates River, diverted the water from the riverbed, and marched his men directly into the city. On the Cyrus cylinder found by archaeologists, Cyrus represents Marduk, the king, the god of Babylon, as being happy in the arrival in Babylon. It gives Marduk credit for making his victory so easy. You see, he was a little misunderstood in the god that was making it so easy, because as we said, God is in the mix. God had judged Babylon. Babylon had served its purpose, and the time for the next kingdom to come in was ready. And so we have the Medo-Persian Empire, which, Lord willing, we'll look at some next Lord's Day evening. It's interesting when we look at Daniel. He was there among the first captives carried into Babylon. And he was an old man. When we read about Daniel in the lion's den, you know how we know this? The Jews were in captivity under Babylon for 70 years. And he was there with the Medes and the Persians. It was during the Medes and the Persians that he was cast into the den of lions because he refused to not petition God. It's interesting when we look at these things. For 70 years, the Jews had remembered Zion. And so when this conqueror came in, they were like, yes, finally. And anyone who knew their Old Testament prophecy, or their prophecy as it was for them, they could remember Isaiah making a prophecy over 100 years prior that Cyrus would return the Jews to their homeland. And it's exactly the decree that is made. It is said that Zerubbabel read the prophecies of Isaiah to Cyrus while he was in Babylon, and this may have caused Cyrus to say, okay, yeah, I'll send you back. And Cyrus not only sent them back, but as we've noted in previous lessons, he sent them back with all the items that had been taken from the temple. He sent them back and helped them on their way and gave them what was needed to rebuild the city, to rebuild the temple. It's just amazing to look at these things and to see in the writings of Isaiah, hundreds of years prior, naming Cyrus as the one who would free them. The Jews were not even in captivity. The Babylonians were just a distant people. And Isaiah is saying, Cyrus, king of the Medes, is going to free you. Once again, we can see that God is there. God is ruling over the world. You see, the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that He sets over it whomever He wishes. You know, if we're going to learn any lesson from looking at the Babylonians, that's the lesson we should learn. That we should not become too arrogant, too almighty in our thinking. Mankind likes to take credit for the work that he does. Cyrus thought that was because of his power and might that he got Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar thought it was because of his power and might that he had received the kingdom and made it into the empire that it was. But as we can see by looking throughout history and by reading the Word of God, we can know that God was there in the mix. Now, as we get into the Medes and the Persians, we're going to be getting into the period of time that is truly between the Testaments. Once again, the Babylonian Empire took place during the days of Daniel. And so these things were all within the writings, but there's very little information given. And so I think it's good to get a background sometimes to look at these things. I appreciate your attention. I know this isn't the typical thing that we look at, but once again, I think this is a period of time that has been horribly overlooked, that many Christians unfortunately know nothing about. And when we look at the Jews during this period of time, we can see a people that were willing to face the hardships before them and remain faithful. In fact, they become more zealous in their service to God during those 70 years that they're in the Babylonian Empire than they were all those years prior under kings such as Hezekiah and Josiah. They turn more to God. And maybe if we look into the world and we see it looks like the church is being exiled, it seems that we're being brought into some form of captivity, we can look and go, okay, this is God saying it's time to turn back to me. And we can look throughout this period of time, this period of 400 years. And once again, you've got the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians. You've got the Grecians, the Syrians, the Ptolemies, all these Greek states, Roman Empire. And God is keeping those Jewish people safe. He's keeping the line of David pure because of the promised Messiah. That Messiah that was promised for all of mankind. The Messiah that Jews still look for, but has already come, has already fulfilled His purpose, and is now in heaven waiting for all who would be faithful to Him. As we noted in our sermon this morning, we have freedom in Jesus Christ. His willingness to go and to die upon the cross, that we can be freed from the heavy, horrible burden of sin. That we can be freed from the fear of death. This was what helped those Jews make it through this difficult time, thinking God is watching out for us. If we turn to God, He's watching out for us. Perhaps you're here, you need to obey the gospel. You need to give your life to Jesus. Then tonight is your opportunity to come forward and confess your belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Repent of your sins, be buried in baptism. But perhaps you've obeyed the gospel, And like the Jews, you've just kind of become complacent. You've forgotten about God. You've gotten caught up in the things that are going on around you. God might be bringing persecutions upon you for that. God might be making life a little more difficult. I'm not saying that if you make things right, everything just all of a sudden becomes rosy. But if we turn to the Lord, even if the world continues to be turned against us, even if life doesn't go the way that we want, we have eternal home in heaven to look forward to. Something that cannot be taken away. So whatever your situation might be, make it right this night as we stand and as we stand.